Thank you, Celeste. Thank you to our colleagues at UChicago Grad for pivoting so quickly and offering this event virtually. Thank you to the five panelists who have taken time out of their day today to be with us. And thank you to the attendees for, for being here. We look forward to having a fruitful and productive discussion. My name is Nick Siemens. I am the Director of the Office of International Affairs and have been at the University of Chicago now approximately 2.5 years. My work prior to the University of Chicago was at Northwestern University, where I was working in a very similar capacity with international students, as well as immigration, advising, and supportive programming. So before I actually ask our panelists to introduce themselves, I wanted to frame the discussion today by sharing with all of you the goals of today's panel discussion. The first really is to help prospective graduate students as they explore employment opportunities in the United States. And today's session is specifically for international students who would like to hear from someone who's been through that process and has been in a similar position. The second is to help international students take away valuable advice as to how they adopted or how they can adopt a different mindset and be successful in a job search process that is different from what they may be used to in their home countries. And the third goal today really is around information from our panelists as to how they navigated the process, how they were successful negotiating job offers, sharing their experiences on the types of realities that international students face and need to be prepared for as they enter the US job market. So with that, I want to ask our panelists, and I will call on you by name just to keep this moving in a in an organized fashion. I'm going to ask you to introduce yourself, where you're from, what did you study here at the University of Chicago, and what profession are you in right now? And we're going to start with Ami.
Hi, everyone. I'm Ami, and I graduated from UChicago in June last year, June 2019. I did the Master of Science in Analytics program there. It was very intense. You know, I tried to finish it in like 5 quarters. It was pretty intense. And I'm currently working with Capital One as a senior data analyst in New York. So I work in liquidity and overdrafts. So it's pretty much like, it's a little crazy now, as you can imagine, with the whole COVID thing, but it's a lot of fun. Yeah.
Thank you, Ami. Next, I'll ask Jun Yoon.
Hey, everyone. I'm Jun. I'm from South Korea, and I'm currently working as a data scientist for a company called Conblock, and It's a consulting firm under McKinsey, which are focusing mainly on data science. And yeah, thanks.
Thank you, June.
Yep.
Next, Claire.
Hey, hello. I'm Claire Wang, and I'm from Hong Kong. I graduated from U of Chicago in 2017 from the Geophysical Science Department, and my research specialized in atmospheric dynamics. So around the time that I graduated, I realized most of the meteorologist's job or things that related to like atmospheric science or satellite requires a security clearance that international students can hardly fulfill. So I start thinking about like switching profession to data science in my last year of grad school. Right now, I'm a senior data scientist in Conversant Media, which is a digital marketing company.
Thank you, Claire. All right, next, Orest.
Hi, I'm Oras Xheria. I come from Albania. I've been here in the University of Chicago, both for my BA and now for my PhD. I did my bachelor's in mathematics, and I'm now working towards the completion of my PhD in linguistics, which is expected to be about end of September. My focus has been in natural language processing, and after graduation, I'm going to work in a technology startup here in Chicago.
Great, thank you. And now Vanessa.
Hi everyone, I'm Vanessa. I recently graduated from the Master of Arts in Social Science program, otherwise known as MAPS. So I graduated in August 2019. Prior to that, my background's in media and communications. So I currently work as a communications manager at a think tank, and it's called ReFed, basically reducing food waste across the US using data and economics. And I serve as the communications manager there.
Terrific. Thank you. Thank you to all of our panelists. We've developed some questions that I will pose to our panelists, but I wanted to just share with the attendees the format for today. I will spend a bit of time, or at least the first half of today's session, asking them to respond to some preset questions. And in the second half of our discussion, we will open it up to the questions that have been provided in the Q&A, in the Q&A box. So Vanessa, we're going to start with you, and I'm going to ask you how your experience at the university prepared you for employment in the United States.
Good question. So I realize I didn't introduce where I'm from. So I'm originally from Kenya, and my focus has been in food anthropology at the university. And I guess one of the things that I like took away from my experience over the last year was just being able to leverage all the networks and the alumni, particularly the alumni network of my program. That was one of the biggest selling points that drew me to the program to begin with. And so whilst I was like midway through my program, I began talking to alumni because they had been in my position, and that's always the best. Like I, you know, as a researcher, as a communications person, you always go to the source of information. You know, the people who have been, who have experienced it, just as what you guys are doing right now. You're asking, you know, you're coming to discuss all these different questions with us. And so I wanted to know who, like what they did in their situation, what sort of organizations that they were pitching themselves to, and also just getting my word out there because, you know, building my brand out there, having not, you know, worked or lived in America, it was a completely different environment. And so being able to understand how I could tailor my prior skill set to what employers want here by listening, like by molding what I currently had to what the expectations were from employers in the US, and using that to grow my understanding of how I could best market myself whenever I there was a job application that I was interested in, or I was meeting a bunch of peers, you know, at a networking event. And so, and that's basically what I took out of that program. The other thing was also being able to broaden my understanding of where my skill sets lied. And so I was always very focused on communications or doing research and understanding that I could apply various forms of my passion and various forms of where my expertise is in different roles. And so understanding that you might come to you know, the University of Chicago thinking right after, you know, you're going straight into one set of path, but understanding that there isn't necessarily a linear path that you should go down, and you shouldn't restrict your understanding of what your future aspirations are based on what you currently have. And being adaptable is basically what I took out of it.
That's great. Thanks, Vanessa. Orest, I'm going to ask you the same question. How has your experience at the university prepared you to navigate this process?
So I'm going to answer this from the perspective of a PhD student at a program that is more on the theoretical side, something that a program that where you know one might not think of there is so much demand of in, you know, more industry-oriented positions. So in my experience, what we get from the university is the very rigorous training. So from a knowledge perspective, the university prepares us very well to tackle any sort of problem we might find in an industry setting. One thing that I found that at least specific to our program wasn't very much the focus of our professors, our instructors, was that the program does not very much prepare us for industry, because there is, and I think this is also the case for other PhD programs as well. There is a heavy focus on pushing students towards academic positions, which in my opinion should not be the case, because first of all, there's limited positions in most fields. In most cases, there are very limited positions which not everyone can get just because of the arithmetics. So what I did to overcome this was basically talk to the people at UChicago Grad. So all of my preparation regarding interviews, best practices, resume and cover letters preparation, or attending workshops with best practices for your academic webpage or your LinkedIn profile. So for me, essentially, it was UChicago Grad that was indispensable in this process of job seeking.
Thank you. Thanks, Orest. Claire, same question to you.
So I second what Orest have mentioned. So after I graduated in 2017, I didn't immediately land on a job. It actually takes me quite a while to land on my current position. So before I got my job, I actually did an internship at Tempus, and that equipped me with plenty of natural language processing skills that is useful for my current position. I got that internship after graduation, and it is through talking to Brianna and the graduate office after consulting her about my career options. And so for me, UChicago mostly provide me with the connections that you can look into different options that are not apparently available if you are just looking around job ads. There are a lot of hidden things, especially for international students. Plenty of companies doesn't really consider visa holder, and you will only find that out through your interview process. And so you will feel I'm so unwanted, no one give me interview opportunities. But then if you are talking to people inside the company, they will tell you how it is like, and you can skip a lot of effort.
That's great. Thanks, Claire. June, how did your experience at the university prepare you for the process?
Right. So first of all, I really utilized a lot on UChicago Grad Career Development Center. So I actually set up a bunch of one-on-one meetings with Joe and other faculties in the UChicago Grad. And they actually helped me with not only going through my resume, but they actually gave me insights on current job market, especially in Chicago. And also there are a bunch of info session. So if you actually reach out to the UChicago Grad earlier, you probably knows in the advance when the info session will happen. And also you get to talk with the recruiter from the company, and that really helped me a lot with job searching. And second, I know people talk about going after UChicago alumni, and that's great, but at the same time, people quite overlook instructors we have in the program, And some of them are professors and some of them are actually the leaders of the industry. Mm-hmm. So please, like, not only just going after alumni, but just talk to your professors and instructors and just ask them if they have any job openings in their own company or some other companies. They have some they are board of directors or something. So we have a great instructors, and I would really empathize students to go after them as well.
Yeah, it's such a good point, and something I know that is a change for many international students is just being informal with your instructors, with your professors, and getting to know them. So that's great. Ami, we'd like to hear from you on this question as well. How did your time at the university prepare you? Oh, I think you're muted.
Okay, sorry.
There we go.
Yeah, hi. So I'm originally from Mumbai in India, and there the job search process is very different when you're in university or in college, because you generally have the kind of career fairs you have are very different. You have companies that come interview you and hire you on the same day, and you don't really have to go out there looking for stuff yourself. And for me, that was a big change here. So I actually started making use of the grad office resources pretty early. I used to go for interview practice. Michael O'Toole, I used to go once every month for 4 or 5 months, just do prep behavioral questions with him, practice those. I met Joe a few times to work on my resume. And then I actually made, I've made very good use of the career fairs. I think I literally went and spoke to almost every single person there. And eventually a couple of the offers I did end up getting were indirect, war through kind of people I'd met through the career fair. So I think for me, that was a big, big boon. And definitely the kind of preparation you get in the program and in the university is very, very rigorous. So that helped, me prep for the technical side of interviews. Because as a data analyst, you do have a bunch of different types of interviews. You have behavioral interviews, you have technical interviews, you have case study interviews. So we also had a consulting club, so I'd go there and practice cases there as well. Mm-hmm. So it was pretty much most of the prep I did was through resources at the university.
That's great. And from all five of you, it sounds like you're getting the skills that you need, from your classes to do these jobs, and you're getting the support and resources from alumni, from your peers, in the program, as well as other support services. Specifically, I know was mentioned by several of you, UChicago grad and career services there, in order to get around the job search, and interview process, and accomplish your goals there. I hear this question a lot that's specific to discussing work authorization and sponsorship with employers. And so for those of you who have gone through that process, we'd like to hear from you. So Ami, I think we'll start with you again.
Sure.
But how did you discuss work authorization and sponsorship, if that has come up already or not, with your current employer?
So generally, my experience was that the minute you have a phone interview with the recruiter, the first thing they ask you is, what's your visa status? So for me, I never really had to go out and sort of ask that upfront, because I think these days, given the current situation and things, even companies are we'd rather not, we probably not spend a lot of time on this process if we know our policies are against it. So at least for me, the experience was people would just upfront, the first recruiter call would be okay, tell me about yourself and what's your visa status and do you anticipate needing sponsorship? So that's the way it would always come up. In the career fairs, it might not have always been so obvious, but then some companies would, at least at the time of the fair, but when you probably follow up with them or, fill in the sort of questionnaires that they sent to you, most of them would have a question in the questionnaire saying, will you now or in the future require sponsorship? Mm-hmm. So I think they're pretty upfront about it. And at least that's been my experience so far.
That's great. June, similar question to you.
Right. So as Ami mentioned, like most of companies are really upfront with the visa sponsorship. So even from the like job postings on online, and even from whenever they come to the like a career fair, they actually set up front that, hey, we do sponsor international students, or hey, we don't sponsor international students. So that was just a first feeder, like filter you can actually use to which company you should apply for. However, one thing I want to say is that especially for STEM students, you can actually work without visa for next 3 years. And if you haven't really like got an offer from the company that doesn't sponsor you right away, then you should also look for companies that doesn't sponsor, because and try to utilize your OPT, which is a 3 years. And I have many friends who actually work in a company that doesn't sponsor your visa, but they actually ended up getting one. Because once the company actually have you and like see your performance, they can make some exception case.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Just like if you really want to work for a certain company that doesn't sponsor your visa, you can actually like try it and ask harder and tell them that, hey, I can actually work without a visa for next 3 years. Can you reevaluate later on or something like mm-hmm. that? You can try that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a terrific point. Thank you, June. Claire, similar question to you. How did you discuss the topic of work authorization or sponsorship?
Okay. Oh, before answering the question, I have a follow-up about June's remark. So mm-hmm. for a STEM student who has OPT, in the first year of OPT, you don't have, like any employers can hire you without them doing anything on their side. But if you are on OPT extension, the employer has to be like a e-verify, like eligible for like e-verify mm-hmm. certain process. So it's not like all employers can do the same thing.
Yeah.
And in order to be like an e-verify, they have to disclose a significant portion of their company information. So that would be a tricky thing. Like it only in the first year, there is no restrictions on the employer. And then back to my case, it is interesting that my company has like a department called the Decision Sciences, which I am in. And when I got in, I realized that a majority of them are internationals. But then for the rest of the company, like the analytics or the client facing departments, they are not hiring any internationals. So for me, it is quite trivial, and they already have the attorney to deal with the visa lottery every year, so I don't really have to talk about that or worry, because like the whole department are almost international. Mm-hmm. That's mm-hmm. my experience. I would suggest that like international students try to consider companies that are like bigger, so that they have better support legally.
Yeah, that's a great point. Mm-hmm. And your point, Claire, about the STEM OPT extension is well made. I think many students sometimes think that simply earning the degree or having a prior earned degree in a STEM field that's eligible for the extension is the only condition, where it is true that the employer that you're working for while you're on the extension must be an E-Verify employer fully.
Yes.
And that's certainly always a good thing to keep in mind and to consider. Orest, how have you navigated this process with potential employers? What's been your experience?
My general experience has been, and I'm seconding Claire's point on this, is that larger companies usually have no issue sponsoring, and they would, in many cases, if a student has the appropriate background, they will, in many cases, sponsor you directly for like an EB2 type visa, which is like a green card type visa. It's an immigration visa, not like a BH1B, which is a non-immigrant visa. But this is usually the case with larger corporations. You know, I've seen this, with Google, Amazon, and these kind of companies coming out. My general feeling has been that if you go for a first technical interview, they already have in their mind that they can sponsor you if you get accepted. So that's not going to be an issue. Mm-hmm. The issue is going to come up right away from, you know, when the recruiter calls you and asks you, as you know, as the guys before we mentioned, you know, will you anticipate needing sponsorship? But if you pass that stage, then sponsorship becomes relevant because they already know it and they will sponsor you. Mm-hmm. Something from my experience has been this: the more offers you have, the more you can negotiate, you know, the sponsorship issue.
That's great. Yeah, thank you, Oris. Vanessa, how did you navigate this part of the process?
Yeah, mine. I think I had quite a broad experience. So I think I even saw a question come up where often, depending on, you know, the organization itself, the question automatically generates in the application form, and that kind of already sells you out. But I'll speak more to when, you know, that doesn't come up immediately. And that was quite the case for a couple of the interviews that I went for. My suggestion is be tactful, be honest, but don't necessarily be the person who brings it up. Reason being, if you already are getting an interview, that means they want something from you. And that is your best way to leverage your skill set and say, look, I'm, you know, a qualified professional in my field. You know, you brought me up. Like, always know that in interview, it's not just you who wants the job, but they want you. Mm-hmm. So know that you also, as like Oris brought, you know, you have some bargaining power in this process. And so when that discussion does come up, it often normally comes up towards the end, most likely in either the mm-hmm. second last or the final interview round. You know, that's another point of view to say, like, look, I actually do have other offers from all these different organizations. Or better yet, as an international student, I actually think sometimes this is a plus when you think about, you know, with most domestic students who have like tons of like student loans, for instance. Well, that's a thing that you don't have to deal with. You know, like they're investing in you for certain reasons, investing in just a minuscule thing like sponsorship. Sponsorship kind of comes up as such a huge thing, but actually it's pretty much just getting a lawyer, you know, it's a very small thing. And a lot of organizations also don't understand it quite clearly, you know. And so being able to spell it out for what it means, like, yes, you know, we will have to go through a couple of months where we have to get immigration lawyers. But what are you getting at the end of this? You know, you're getting a dedicated, you know, professional in this, you know, who can, you know, contribute to your, you know, your organization's mission, your goals, your objectives, and this is why you should hire me. So being able to be tactful and strategic in the way you bring it up. But then if it does come up, then be completely honest, because if a year comes, you know, if you're on OPT and, you know, your year is over and, you know, you have to bring up that awkward discussion, oh, hey, you know, can you sponsor me, you know, that already shows your lack of integrity. So understand that, yes, it is a very difficult and a very awkward discussion to have, but you must, you know, because you never know what might happen down the line. And again, they might not necessarily be open to it, and they might not explicitly say so. And then another thing, correct me if I'm wrong, Nick, but they can't discriminate against the fact of your citizenship status. So it's not a question that you have to answer, similar to like whether like your salary earnings, you can evade that question on that principle. And so I would just say be tactful. And that's what I did. With the current position that I'm in, I was very open about it, but they were also very open. In fact, it was one of the reasons why they wanted me, because they saw diversity as something that they wanted to invest in. Mm-hmm. And they actually offered it right away, rather than, you know, they were like, oh, they didn't even understand what OPT was, because they, and so it's just, again, it's A, just knowing that not all organizations or companies are the same, and being able to adapt to different situations.
Absolutely. And we'll make a few comments to that. You know, the first is, you know, ensuring that you're aware of your options. As June and some of you have brought up, there are employment benefits, you know, built into your student visa status, whether that's an F1 or J1, you may be, you know, or likely are eligible for some amount of post-graduation employment authorization. For some of you, that could be limited to 12 months. For others, you know, it could fully extend, you know, to the to the 36 months if you're STEM eligible, or if you're a PhD student on a J visa and eligible for academic training for that full amount of time. And the second, you know, piece to that is that the Office of International Affairs, you know, can act as a resource, you know, to you. We, along with UChicago Grad, have come up with a really useful manual or guide to the job search process for international students. If you've not seen that, I think it's in the process maybe of even being, you know, posted electronically, so it will become available soon. But definitely knowing your options and being able to, you know, convey to an employer that, you know, you don't need sponsorship immediately, and you may have, you know, time, you know, that you can remain sponsored on visas with the University of Chicago, but, you know, at a certain point you will want to make that transition. All really good points. Before we actually go to the questions, I want to ask one final question to our panelists, and that is, what would you do differently as a student at the University of Chicago if you could go back in time now? So Vanessa, we'll start with you, and then we'll come back around.
I would say one thing that I'm still learning to do more is just to be kinder to myself and understand that, you know, the disappointment that, and there will be a lot of that. I am honestly telling you, you will get tons and tons of rejections, but not internalizing that. And that could be, and it could come from multiple factors. It could be, again, just because they didn't want to hire you, or they had somebody else, and this was just a publicity stunt where they had to, you know, advertise a particular role. And it's knowing that being more, being more mentally prepared for that, but also one thing that I will, maybe not something that I would do differently, but that I wish I did more of, was understanding that the process of just relearning and unlearning. You know, a lot of us have had, you know, different experiences, and UChicago is a very, as everyone has said, a very rigorous space where, you know, you have so many people who are such, you know, knowledgeable, you know, just brainiacs and everything, and not to compare yourself and not to compare your situation, because I worked prior to my program, and so I'm in a different position to somebody like Orest, who's been a PhD, you know, he has like a better grasp of, you know, the theoretical field than, you know, some of us, or being able to understand that like my situations are completely different to other people, and so not getting bogged down by, you know, if my classmates or my colleagues or my contemporaries, you know, are getting more responses in their interviews, like trying not to internalize that criticism, but using that as kind of a way to, you know, improve yourself. Like I always view like all the interviews where I may not have gotten, you know, the response I wanted, I view that as an opportunity. Like I was like, well, that was a practice round, you know, I was being prepared for another door. And that's just, I could speak endlessly about this, so if there are things that you do want to hear about, but there's a lot of takeaways that you can take from these quote unquote rejections or, you know, missed opportunities, and using that as a better way to like kind of like just change gear. Like learning, that's one thing. Just understand that, you know, like that, you know, you can view it as a missed opportunity, or you can view it as a door being shut so that you could be elevated somewhere else.
Yeah, and it's valuable perspective for sure. Yeah, absolutely. Thank you. June, what would you do differently if you could go back in time?
Sure. Well, I can only say for my current career, which is a data science. So if I go back to my UChicago student time period, I would probably spend a lot of time to figure out what kind of research area I should focus on. So UChicago has by the way, I graduated from this master's in analytics program in Graham, and they don't really have, like Graham School, they don't really have any lab, but UChicago has a lot of lab based on the different like research, like data science research, like natural language processing or some Bayesians, and we have a great professors. So if I go back, I would probably like look for which specialized field in data science I should focus on, and based on that focus, I will do, like, I will ask for lab or research experience. Because if somebody asks, I'm probably going to, like, answer it later. But it took me, it was so much more difficult for me to find an internship than a full-time. Mm. And if you have a research experience, if you have a lab experience, you will be more well-shaped when you apply for full-time. And I'm participating in a lot of interviews for my company as well. And I see that a lot of students just don't have any experience. And sadly, all the experiences you have from your home country might not take for full credit. And mm-hmm. that happened to me as well. So,
yeah, so excellent. Just for that reason, as well.
Yeah.
For that, yeah. Yeah. Thank you, Jun. Claire, how about you? If you could go back and do anything differently as a student, as you were navigating the job search process, what would that maybe be?
I only changed my mind that I shall try out options in the industry in my very last year. But I think if I could have such mindset, or like just keep an open mind on all different career options, maybe in my second year or third year, do an internship and see how it was like, it will be, I think it will make the job search process much easier. So I have to tell you that I actually took 11 months, like since graduation, to get my current job. And it was just 1 month before the OPT first year expires. So if I can move the internship and everything before my OPT starts, I think it would be much easier. So just keep an open mind and talk to people of different backgrounds. So like going to be a postdoc and professor, that's not the only option you have for PhDs.
Right, right. Yeah, no, great. Orest.
Yeah, I cannot stress this this point that June and Claire made enough. The thing that I would do differently, like, is do more internships. I started doing internships relatively late, but not too late. I started doing my first internship was at the end of my fourth year, and it was with IBM. But that it took me an insane amount of interviews and, you know, rejections for me to get that position. And it would have been so much easier to get a position at an internship position at a very good company if I had done some, you know, internships at some more modest companies in the past. So if your timeline allows it, if your advisor, you know, if you're in a PhD program is okay with it, and, you know, if it's something that, even if it's marginally in your mind that, you know, you may not want to be in academia, you should definitely do internships. It's the amount of interviews I got after I had done an internship compared to before is insane. So definitely do that.
Yeah, no, that's great. And Ami, to give you the same opportunity to answer this question. Oh, I think you're muted once more.
Sorry, I don't know, it just keeps happening automatically. Sorry about that. I don't know, press the button, but yeah. So I think for me, the experience was slightly different. I didn't do an internship. And honestly, I think that worked out well for me because the length of my program was like really short. So my program was like, I finished in 5 quarters. And since I started in spring, I would have been eligible for an internship only in winter, because after 3 quarters of full-time enrollment, and that was pretty much the time when I needed to be searching for a job anyway. Because so I kind of decided to sort of combine both searches. And at that point, my mindset was like, if I get an internship, great, I'll do that. If I get a full-time job, great, I'll take that. So like whatever works out for me at the time. One thing I would like do differently is not be so hard on myself. Like every time, you know, I'd wake up every day to rejection emails, and that happens a lot. Like, because I don't know, they send out automated rejections at night. I don't know, but every day you wake up and you see those rejection emails first in the morning, you're like, great, that's just like, my day's just going to go so well now. but yeah, so I think after, like, learning to take that in my stride would have definitely helped me, because that did make me very negative at one point, because I'd be like, you know, how stupid do I have to be that I keep being rejected? And but then sure. I think you kind of if you take it in the sense that it's all just practice, and that's what started happening a little later. Like every time I do a take-home test for a company, and like, you know, sometimes I'd feel like I've done a really good job and I still get rejected, but it's like you don't realize why companies are rejecting you. It could be that there are other people ahead of you in the pipeline. It could be that, you know, they're looking for someone else. But I think what happens is that you beat yourself up. So I think learning to take that as practice for the companies that are actually going to work out for you, I think that's a more positive way to do things. So I would have tried to tell myself that if I had the chance to talk to myself back in the program, that, hey, this is all just practice. You do two more tests now. You probably do the test that really matters really well because you've just practiced so much now.
Yeah.
So I think for me, that would have been the biggest thing, like, you know, stressing out over every single rejection. And sure. Or another thing, don't compare yourself to other people. Like if classmates get a job before you, it's very typical to just be like, oh my god, like everyone's getting jobs except for me.
Yeah.
But then I think, you know, ultimately you do find the job and the company that's a good fit for you. And I think accepting that if an interview doesn't work out, it probably means that there was something of a mismatch. Mm-hmm. I think you realize that more than once you start working and you really like your job, you kind of realize that, oh, there's a reason why that didn't work out, because I probably fit here much better.
It's a good life lesson in general.
Yes.
Not to compare yourselves.
Yeah, good. Nick, well, sorry, I just want to add just one tiny little detail, because Amy just reminded me of that. One of the things that I will stress and emphasize that even with those rejection letters is that when you do get an offer and it's something that you're not necessarily like 100%, I know there's often that pressure because, you know, you are waiting for that, you know, your OPT deadline is coming up or your mm-hmm. STEM extension that you might just spring towards something. Don't be afraid to say no, you know, if it doesn't feel like the right fit, because, you know, you do kind of, I've had situations where I have had multiple offers, but it just, something felt wrong. Or the packet, you know, the benefit, they weren't offering benefits. There are just so many red flags. Just, you know, think about it. Is this really worth it? At the end of the day, you know, it's great to get the opportunity to work in the US, but if, you know, what, you know, the offers that are, you know, that are being presented on the table just aren't at the caliber of where you are, then don't be afraid to say no to them and, you know, look
that's
somewhere
great
else.
Too. That, the power of no, for sure, in those situations. And that can be scary. I want to transition to some of the questions that have come in live. The first, perhaps being slightly objective, but the first question, do you think the current pandemic recession will disproportionately or negatively affect hiring international students? Will companies be less likely to go through the potentially lengthier process, for example? And I think this is a really timely, you know, question for sure. And I don't know that, you know, any of us, you know, can answer that in a very clear way as the current situation even continues to evolve. So, you know, I think the current situation is unprecedented, and it will be difficult to know how companies will react to this. And also in the context of companies, you know, here in the US versus companies abroad in other locations around the world who may be, you know, working through the current situation, you know, in a different way. So Livia, I know that maybe isn't a very succinct answer, but I think that's as good as we can potentially do now. The next question, and I think I'll pose this, what I'll do is just call on a panelist to answer, and we'll just try to move through as many of these questions as we can. So maybe not all five of you will have the opportunity to answer. The next question that came in, when an online job application asks if you will require visa sponsorship in the future, how do you answer this? Do you answer truthfully? Do you answer truthfully, or will that screen you out instantly? June, I'm going to ask you that question. How did you approach this, answering this question, if you did?
Right. So every single time when I apply for an online job application, I always says, yes, I need a sponsorship. And there is additional comments that you can put in and say that, hey, I'm an OPT STEM, so I don't really require, like, right away, but in the future, I need a sponsorship.
Great. Yeah, thank you. Anybody else have thoughts on that? Similar, it sounds like? Okay, great. We'll continue moving. The next question. So if I graduate with a STEM major, I will first have 1 year of OPT, and then in order to have the additional 2 years, I need to work with my employer to submit the application. Am I correct about this point? I think this person is talking about the standard 12-month OPT and then the additional 24-month OPT extension. And I'm happy to field that. Both the standard 12-month OPT application as well as the STEM 24-month application will be something that you continue to work with the Office of International Affairs to prepare and submit to USCIS. So just remember that while you're on OPT, your visa status continues to be sponsored by the university, and you would continue to work with your OIA advisor to navigate both of those applications. The STEM OPT application does require some specific information from your employer, as well as the completion of a training plan between your direct supervisor and you as part of that process. Remember also that OIA holds monthly, if not twice monthly, OPT workshops throughout the year, especially at times of the year where we know many students will be applying. The next question I think would be for our data scientists. How long does it take to get promoted to a senior role? I don't know, June or...
Let me take the question. So there's no clear answers. The reason is that like senior data scientist role is not like it means completely different from company to company. And even for my company, when I participate in a lot of interviews, even though they were like playing senior data scientist role for like 4 years, if it doesn't meet our senior data scientist role criteria, we just give an offer as a data scientist. Mm-hmm. And even for our senior data scientists, when they move to different company, they become like director of something. So it's not necessarily like there's no clear answer to these questions. And also it depends on your performance. Mm-hmm. So.
Mm-hmm. Claire, did you have anything that you wanted to add to that about senior roles as a data scientist?
Well, I think it depends on company. Like I promoted to senior data scientist like after a year I joined, and like mm-hmm. everyone is slightly different. And when I was doing internship at Tempest, I know that in their group, there is just data scientist and the director or the team lead. So there is not even a position called a senior data scientist there. So it really varies. Okay. Across companies.
Yeah, good. Thank you. The next question, again, I will field, asks us to talk a bit more about the E-Verified employer. So remember, for the 24-month OPT extension, two conditions have to be met. The first is that you earned a STEM-eligible degree, either at the University of Chicago or even at a prior level. And the second being that while you are working on the 24-month OPT extension, you are working for an employer that is fully subscribed to the government's E-Verify program. So it's difficult to know, you know, which employers are subscribed to E-Verify. There is a website on the USCIS webpage that allows you to search by company name. But one caveat that I will add to that is that if you do see a company's name on that website, it may not mean that they are fully subscribed to E-Verify. It could simply mean that they use E-Verify for only certain projects or procurement purposes. So definitely better to ask your employer or your employer's HR department about their standing in E-Verify, and they'll be able to help you complete that process. Good question. The next question, and I'm going to pose this to just a few of you if you have comments about this at all. How has COVID-19 changed your company's hiring processes, if at all? Any tips for international students dealing with the possible slowdown in the coming year? Ami, I'm going to ask you if you have heard you know, anything from your company being a very large company, you know, around the world?
Mm-hmm. So far, definitely people are trying to assess how things are going to pan out, but in general, I haven't really heard of, you know, slowdowns per se. But I've actually heard of people, in fact, being onboarded virtually right now. Like, so they're mm-hmm. shipping people laptops and doing their training virtually. Mm-hmm. So at least that seems like an optimistic sign to me. So,
absolutely.
Yeah. So absolutely. More than that, honestly, I wouldn't really have information on that. But what I can tell you is that at least in my company, people seem to be still be starting on their appointed start dates. Like, I haven't really heard of people's start dates being deferred or like put off mm-hmm. for now.
Okay, great. Great. Does anyone else want to chime in on that?
I would say it might also differ by whether you're for profit or nonprofit. So I can speak maybe for the nonprofit side of things, that there's a lot of precarity because, you know, the organizations like NGOs are dependent on external funding. Mm-hmm. So I think it really depends on the field that you're in. So I work in the food waste, you know, food system sector. Right now there is a food crisis. So we are getting a lot more funding in, and we have been hiring. These are positions that were posted prior to the crisis, but it would largely depend on what sector. And I think that's maybe a thing that I would advise international students is, if you are a data scientist, whether knowing like what are certain fields where there is a need for people in a specific subsect. As of yet, I do know that a lot of, like, depending on the size of the NGOs, they are downscaling, but there could potentially be more need. And it doesn't necessarily have to be like traditional forms of employment. You know, you can go for remote virtual positions. So that I don't think would necessarily disadvantage you. Another thing is, you are in the country at the moment. So provided you're here, you know, there isn't that option. Like, if you're looking for OPT, I don't think that would put you in any like different position than you would be, whether or not there is a pandemic going on.
Sure. Sure. Yeah, no, that's great. Really good. Okay. We're going to keep moving. An interesting question. What shaped your decision to apply for a job in the US rather than other countries, for example, your home country? I'm gonna ask Orest, actually, if you could chime in on this.
Sure. So I mean, the main point here is that the kind of thing that I study natural language processing is not as developed in Europe in general as it is here. So that's mm-hmm. like a direct a reason of why I chose the U.S. The U.S. is at the moment a leader in this field. That's one of the main reasons. Another reason is that one thing that you get with U.S. companies depends from company to company, is that along with your, you know, role as a scientist, you also get some freedom to, you know, pursue the occasional publication if the company is alright with it, which is something that I would like to keep doing in the company without having the pressure, you know, that one has in the PhD to publish, because, you know, you have to complete the program mm-hmm. and the dissertation mm-hmm. and so on and so forth. So these are like two of the very important reasons for me.
Good. Yeah. Thank you. One question that is kind of popping up over and over after the initial interview and being offered and accepting a position, or perhaps before you've accepted, how did you, or do you have tips on negotiating salary if you were looking for, you know, a job that paid? I'm gonna ask Vanessa, actually, if you wanna chime in on this one, and we can open it to some of the other panelists as well.
Yeah, this was something that I was not familiar with, because in Kenya, and I was in Australia before, like, there's just a standard salary that's fixed, like, prior to you even applying for the role. And so I really took advantage of Catherine at UChicago Grad. And then the career advisors in my specific program, and just understanding like how exactly, you know, does this, you know, take place. I even did mock salary negotiations. Mm-hmm. And again, do the research, know what the standard rates are for your position, for your like your level of experience, and also for the region that you're in. Like Chicago, you're lucky in the Midwest, you know, we're above places like in the South and everything. And so this was just don't give a salary, don't give a number, because the moment you give a number, you kind of already kind of downplay, you know, you lose your bargaining chip. And so I would often evade that question until the very end. Namely because, you know, you box yourself by giving yourself like a specific salary range. Mm-hmm. So I often answer that question. I'm interested in this position, and my salary expectations are in line with what is out there in the field and what you had initially, because they as an organization or as a company already know what they have budgeted for this position. So don't give them any reason to go down on that. Mm-hmm. But once you do get, you know, and salary discussions normally come towards the end, and at that point, that's when you really have to go back to your elevator pitch and brand yourself and be like, look, I am the most qualified candidate because of X, Y, Z. And that way, and that's when you can start playing, start bargaining. But I would often, again, go back to whether it's going to UChicago grad or the specific career advisors or your alumni or your mentors. I often always use my mentors as a resource and saying, okay, is this a fair salary? Can I negotiate further? And also knowing that even though you might not necessarily, you know, it could be a 5,000 difference to what you were expecting, there are various other things that you can negotiate. I've negotiated, like currently I've actually negotiated time off on days that are public holidays in my own country. And that was something that you can add on. So knowing that, I mean, that's just one example, but you can, you know, there are various other forms of benefits that you can negotiate for outside mm-hmm. of your actual remuneration that you're getting. So
All good points. Yeah, definitely. I know that before Claire, before I turn it over to you, I know that Ami actually has to duck out. She was able to carve out an hour for us, and we definitely appreciate that. Thank you for participating today, and have a great rest of the day and weekend.
Thank you so much. Sorry you have to leave. Take care.
Bye-bye. Bye. Claire, you had you wanted to add a few notes to the negotiation question.
Yes. One very important information. So Vanessa has spoken for like the case for NGO, for profit industry companies. So when they are applying for the CAP H-1B for their employees, they have to disclose the salaries of like all of them. And this can be found online. You can know.
Very true.
You can know who is being paid, like for how much. Just go online to search for the H-1B database. You know.
Yeah. Thank you. No, that's good. One additional question, and I know we're quickly, you know, racing toward the end of our session today, but we'll try to get through as many as we can between now and the next, you know, 10 to 12 minutes. After applying for an internship and getting rejected for it, do you think that a company would ghost you for a certain amount of time if you want to now apply for a full-time position?
I can answer June. This question.
Yeah.
So like for my case, I apply for my current company for internship and I get rejected, and now I'm working for the company. So yes, it's not, I mean, they will not ghost you. And also you can ask HR in upfront.
Also
I know my friend who's working at Amazon, and he applied for 30 multiple different positions for Amazon, and he got all rejected, but he's still working in Amazon. So
good. I think it's important always to remember that internship programs can sometimes be very different from full-time positions, for sure. Another question, and I'm gonna pose this: any good job hunting approaches and or platforms to recommend, especially for international students? So maybe how did you find listings, you know, for available or open positions? Oris, do you want to take this one?
Sure. So the one I predominantly used was LinkedIn. It has pretty much everything I need. Plus, you know, you get to have your profile there too. But some other ways I used for, you know, for finding positions, sometimes some positions are not posting on LinkedIn for, you know, XYZ reasons. So I had in mind, like, I had prepared a list of companies, of tech companies that I wanted to work for. And I always would go, I would, you know, occasionally look at their, you know, job postings websites, their own websites to see about positions, which in many cases were not posted in LinkedIn. So you get some extra openings in that sense. But for my case, what also works, and this might be only the case for like research-oriented roles, is Twitter. Because many of the researchers that, you know, in labs, in industry labs or in like university labs, they would post their, you know, their openings they have for internships or for full-time roles in their, you know, in the Twitter account. And sometimes, in most cases, these things are not posted like in LinkedIn. So you have to go to the particular company and look through the company, which you may very easily miss.
That's great. Yeah, no, thank you.
I want to add one point.
So yeah,
besides the like online job application, all the Oris mentioned, people also hire a lot of like new employees through the conference and a meetup, and that's really effective.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So just yeah.
No, that's terrific. Claire, a specific question for you about the health data fellowship experience. Was it competitive to get in, and how should a PhD student prepare to apply for that?
So I guess this question is not really relevant to the context of like international students. But so first thing I want to say is that this Insight Data Science Fellowship would not count as an employer that can host your OPT. And so this is something that you have to bear in mind. And then let's see. So how do I prepare for it? And like, is it competitive? So in my year, like only 6% of the applicants successfully get into the program. And so it is pretty competitive. And to prepare for it, you mostly need a data science project from end to end. And during the interview, you present it, walk it from start to end, how you collect data, how you build a model to solve a business problem. I don't think it is really difficult to get in, like in terms of like technical requirement, but like you have to be a likable person and like social well with the with the PIs in order to like give them a good impression, because they are pitching you to some companies, right? So you are a product they are selling to them.
Yeah, good. Yeah, thank you. Thank you for that. A question has come up about doing internships and needing CPT. And I want to just remind the attendees that CPT authorization is for internships while you are in your academic program. So for example, over summer, you would need CPT. But keep in mind also that during your standard period of initial OPT, you can be taking internships that are paid or unpaid. The Office of International Affairs OPT page has some real good information and examples about what constitutes as employment while on OPT. So just wanted to answer that question as well. Looking through the other questions here. A question about completing job application forms where answering the visa question is compulsory. The question being, what tips do you have to evade this? And I think we maybe answered that question by saying that you should not evade that question, that you should answer it honestly, and provide additional comments if there is a comment section around your eligibility for OPT or academic training that may not immediately require employer sponsorship. So I hope that that answers that question. there's a question here. Let me just have a look. Question about international students, maybe who use their OPT period at the same level that they're currently at the University of Chicago and who may not have OPT. So how to approach, you know, interviews with employers when OPT is maybe not available. And, you know, I'm happy to take that and say that if you are in that situation, it would certainly be a good idea for you to look at multinational companies, large companies who maybe have locations or offices around the world where you potentially could at least start working for the company in another area and then potentially join in the US on an H-1B or even an L-1 intercompany transfer, you know, down the road. There's a question from a current postdoc at the university who has maybe a very specific question, but to what extent do you think not having earned a PhD from a US institution could have a negative impact on employment opportunities? I don't know if any of you, Vanessa, do you want to take a stab at that?
Yeah, I can answer that question. So again, it depends on what your sector is, but I'll say for the most part, like this can be, and again, I can generalize, diversify your experience, whether that's academic or professional, like that's just a rule of thumb. Mm-hmm. And personally, from what I know, in the NGO world, communications, majority of the time having a PhD, like having a PhD directly, like if you have like little breathing room between each degree, that actually puts you in a very negative boat, because employers at the end of the day want applicable skills. And, you know, if you're not in a practical field where, you know, you're doing physics or you're doing data science, and if you're more in a theoretical field, I would say that you're not really at a disadvantage. And so be able to kind of, diversify and brand. And so being able to show an employer exactly how your field of study directly, you know, relates to what, you know, what their organization or what their company does is the best way forward. So I wouldn't necessarily stress on having a PhD because, again, at the end of the day, you know, depending on where you're, what advanced level of degree you have, that means that you should be earning a certain level of money. But if you can't even do the basic things, if you can't even, you know, manage a project, you can barely even create an Excel sheet or deliver a presentation, or, you know, you don't have those basic things, then you're actually less qualified than somebody coming straight out of a bachelor's degree. Mm-hmm. So kind of understanding how, is it just, you know, don't get a PhD for the sake of getting a PhD, but how exactly are you utilizing that PhD program? You know, if you are an engineering student, you know, that makes absolute sense. You know, an architecture student where you need all that training, that rigorous training, in order to stand out, or, you know, because that it's required, you know, you require those certifications. But other than that, it's, again, knowing, I'm not too sure what field the person who posed this question, but I'm happy to discuss this offline. But it's, again, knowing exactly how, whatever you're doing, whether that's a PhD program, whether that's volunteering, whether that's an internship, kind of reverse engineer, you know, those questions. How is this, what merit am I gaining from this? What return on investment does it bring mm-hmm. towards me? And how can I sell this story? Because, you know, that's one of the first questions you'll always be asked, like, tell us about you and why did you do this PhD program? You know, understanding how that fits into your general narrative of you as a professional is very mm-hmm. important to keep in mind.
Thank you.
Let me add one thing. If you're doing the PhD in your home country, that doesn't have any negative impact on your job application.
Right. Yeah. Right. Yeah. No, that's also a good point. June, and maybe an open question as our final question, but June, can you introduce us to the hiring process that you went through, given that you were an analytics student. Did you have to take any online tests or complete a case study? And how many rounds, you know, the interview process did you experience?
Right. So it depends on the company. So like one of the, I apply most of the consulting firms in US, like top maybe six. And some company actually have three rounds, and my company actually had like eight rounds. And they, most of them have a like coding test. And the best way to practice those like a HackerRank test is to use HackerRank. And there are so many online platforms which kind of helps you to shape your coding skills. And some company actually ask you for like algorithm coding like challenge, but some people, like some company actually ask for data science challenge rather than some algorithm challenge. So for data science type of like data science challenge type of question, you can actually prepare by doing multiple Kaggle competition. So if you can shape yourself with a HackerRank and a Kaggle, then you should be able to accomplish any of the first round coding tests that any company you provide.
That's great. Yeah, thank you. Anybody else want to chime in on that, you know, in terms of the interview process, the number of rounds, whether they had to complete a case study or a test, another?
I did multiple behavioral and thought exercises. So that's just another one. Again, I'm more less of the technical and more of communications field, where a lot of the times with that, it's more necessarily just being given something to, you know, you're actually being given work to do. So I would, one of the things that I would just generally advise is do your homework beyond just, you know, selling yourself. But, you know, once you're doing an interview, it's really about focusing on them. So really understand what exactly does this organization do, because you'd be alarmed by the amount of people who just, you know, when you do blind applications, you kind of forget, okay, why did I apply to that company or this company?
Sure.
But what are they doing exactly? And so that will come out a lot in the interview. And one of the things that, depending on what round you are, don't, even though the question might not come up, find a way to weave, you know, those stories. Like there might be something that you missed out in the first round. You can always bring that up and be conversational and just, again, just be organic. Like just do as much as you can to A, understand what exactly this role is. And in that, in those interviews, kind of tease that out from them so that, you know, there sometimes organizations put very ambiguous terms like, we want somebody who has analytical skills. Okay, exactly what type of analysis? Do you want qualitative? Do you want quantitative? And so using that time as a way to really understand in depth of what is expected, but also finding ways of how you can market yourself better, even though that isn't something that is part of the exercise, is something I would just advise on.
Yeah, that is a perfect note to wrap up on. I know that... we are exactly at time now. I want to thank all of the panelists for taking time out of your day today and sharing this information, you know, with the, you know, over 80 attendees that, you know, joined us this afternoon. And thank the attendees for making time in their day as well. Just to reiterate, UChicago grad, as well as Office of International Affairs and many other offices on campus are available to you as resources, as are your peers and alumni. And here we had five join us this afternoon. So thank you to UChicago grad for putting this together and for doing such a great job. And thank you all. Have a wonderful afternoon and a good weekend.
Thank you. Bye, take care.
Thank you.
Thanks, everyone.